Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Christian has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore.
To go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast. I am Jason Mann. Usually with me is Rich Krejci, but he's on assignment this time, we'll say. And so joining me is the Hardwood Paroxysm Editor-in-Chief, Ian Levy. He also runs the Nylon Calculus Advanced Statistics blog and also is the host of the R-Squared podcast, which is also part of the Podium Game Network. And Ian, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We've looked at snapshots of the current players from the top 50, the greatest players list made in 1996, along with Curtis Harris. We've kind of given our initial impressions, both using some statistics, mostly win shares and win shares per 48, but a few others as well, and anecdotal evidence, historical cases, that perspective coming from Curtis primarily. Next we're going to be kind of looking at the both the post-1996 players and also re-examine some of the cases of the current guys in the top 50 who, you know, maybe we need to look at more deeply, who we haven't really kind of made a firm decision on. And we'll be relying on stats a lot, so we thought we'd have you on the show who is, you know, well-versed in statistics and kind of talk about some of the strengths and limitations of what the numbers can tell us.
Great, yeah, I definitely... historical eras are not my area of expertise. I'm much more well versed in the current crop of NBA players, but I definitely have some thoughts. I'm excited to talk about it.
So let's say you are looking at a player of the past that you're probably, you know, that you're not real familiar with. You know, what are some of the things that you are going to look at from a numbers perspective to try to, you know, kind of give some evaluation for them?
Well, there's two avenues. So one is I want to understand what kind of player they were. And then, you know, if you want to put them into a historical framework or some sort of ranking framework, you want to think about how good they were compared to their contemporaries and maybe compared to, you know, the larger pool of players in the history of the NBA. So, obviously, Basketball Reference is the starting point. Their player pages are rich, and they go all the way back. So, thinking about what kind of player this person was, I'd look at their player page, and I'd be examining everything I could find there. So, you know, even for players way back where there's not a lot of video available, just the statistics can inform somewhat. About like the style that the player played. So maybe they're a big, but they have a lot of balance between rebounds and assists or blocks and steals. And that's an indicator of a player who can sort of slide back and forth between roles and who could play on the inside and could also play on the perimeter a little bit. If they're, a big man who maybe has a low free throw total, or a low free throw attempts, that's maybe an indicator that they were more of a jump shooter or somebody who played a little bit on the outside. So things like that can sort of give you a little bit of information about the way that a player played. And I think all of those things are really important about understanding the style of play, putting that into the historical context of you know, the era that they played in. And then, you know, things like how long their career lasted and how long their prime was. Those are things that can help inform sort of from a larger evaluative standpoint.
Yeah. You know, one thing that has always vexed me a little bit is the longevity versus the peak. You know, how much we value, you know, being very, very good for a long time versus being great for a shorter time. And that's always kind of a difficult way to, you know, to weigh some of these. And I'm sure that this is going to be something that we're going to have to consider when talking about, you know, maybe the last five or so guys on our top 50 and kind of, you know, weighing those two factors, because that's definitely a difficult thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to become increasingly relevant with when you want to talk about the current crop of players, because, technological advances and an understanding of rest and health and injury and all of those things, it seems like top players are having longer and longer careers and longer primes. You take somebody like Dirk Nowitzki, who, you know, arguably was maybe only a top five player in the league for maybe one or two seasons, but was in the top 10 for, you know, more than a decade now. And his prime, you know, his prime has just sort of slowly ebbed away. And so you sort of have to take that into account about, yeah, there's sort of the shape of a player's career arc. I think it's a really interesting question.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, pre-1990, there's, you know, maybe a handful of guys who were effective players, you know, after age 35. I mean, Kareem, Moses Malone, Elvin Hayes, you know, a couple others. But that's really, you know, that's really about it. And now, you know, this generation has, you know, a number of guys who are still really, you know, great players in their late 30s, and probably, you know, I imagine we'll have more as it goes along. So that's, you know, that's the thing. I mean, that's another thing, is that I want to try to avoid, and I believe Rich feels the same way, of having the weight tilted too far toward modern players, because, you know, both because of the longevity and both because, you know, as the game has evolved, you know, some of the statistical measures, you know, they've just improved in those things. I mean, people shoot better than they used to. You know, they're more athletic. They're just able to produce, you know, at high levels. There's obviously exceptions, but, you know, for the most part, you know, what are some ways to kind of, you know, you could consider, you know, sort of the different, eras in both, and not, you know, like, for one example I thought that was good was Curtis Harris looked at an example like Jermaine O'Neal. Like, Jermaine O'Neal had such a long career and was, you know, a pretty good player for a while, that he's just so high on, you know, let's say the level of, you know, Winchers, and even Winchers per 48, he's probably pretty strong too. How do you avoid, like, you know, rewarding guys like that? Not that he's quite a top 50 candidate, but rewarding guys who maybe are kind of have that case, while avoiding penalizing somebody who, you know, didn't have that longevity but was, you know, almost certainly a better player, but maybe doesn't quite show it, you know, you don't quite see it in the numbers.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a balance, right? So you want to take the statistics, and if you're talking about something like building a list of the 50 greatest players, you want to take the cultural context and the cultural importance of players, and balance that with the statistics. So, you know, somebody like Jermaine O'Neal will maybe look great by win share measures, in part because he's playing 82 game seasons. You know, I mean, he's been injured, but he's playing 82 game seasons for his whole career, which is more opportunities to rack up win shares, and that's, you know, that's another advantage that modern players have with regards to something like win shares. It's a cumulative statistic. More minutes, more games means more opportunities to accrue win shares. So maybe you look at win shares and you're looking at, you know, their peaks and so not just their total, but what were their peak seasons like, and how do those peak seasons compare to players before? And then, you know, you want to balance the statistics with understanding how important was this player at the time that they played. Basketball Reference has a numeric formula that rates the likelihood of players being inducted into the Hall of Fame. And it uses some statistics, some of the player statistics, but it also uses things like All-Star Game selections, MVP voting, All-NBA selections, All-NBA defensive selections, things like those. And so those are some ways that you can sort of compare the player to their peers at the time that they played. The other thing that's interesting is, you know, if cultural importance is part of the formula, there are some players whose cultural performance is probably elevated by the fact that they only played for a short time and, you know, and maybe sort of flamed out quickly. You know, Yao Ming, you know, is a case where he, you know, he was here, he was dominant when he could be on the court, and he didn't last that long. And the fact that our image of him is just sort of these brief dominant seasons, and then, you know, and then he was gone, we sort of, you know, maybe not having the chance to sort of watch him break down slowly over 7 or 8 years, maybe that makes him seem better or more important or whatever than he, you know, maybe would have been if we had watched him over a full career.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, and Bill Walton is certainly, you know, very much the case of that, where, you know, he was so good, but for a relatively short time. And, you know, the, I think the cultural importance, it kind of gives him the boost on, you know, on the original top 50 list. And just, you know, for his peak, he was amazing. And obviously, what do you think about, how much do you consider team success? I mean, I think that, you know, I think it's pretty important, because the best players in basketball are so important to their teams and really do make such a significant difference. I mean, basketball is obviously a team sport, but those, you know, transcendent great players do mean so much that I do think that there is some weight should be, you know, for being, you know, a top, you know, best player or top one or two, three contributors to, you know, a championship team, multiple championship teams. I do think that should, some weight should be given to that. I'm not a count the rings guy, but I do at least have some basic sympathy for, like, okay, if you're the best player, one of the best players in the league, you probably should have some championships, and with some exceptions, obviously.
Yeah, I sort of go both ways. Like, I think about a case like Anthony Davis, and like this season, you know, he didn't finish he sort of wasn't a realistic or a viable MVP candidate for a lot of people, because the Pelicans just barely squeaked into the playoffs. Ironically, it seemed like that was not as much of an issue for people when it came to Russell Westbrook. But Davis was, without a doubt, one of the three best players in the league this year statistically. And, you know, so I think it was sort of unfair that he was penalized for having not as great teammates and having teammates who, you know, struggled with injury all year. On the same token, when it comes to things like championships and finals appearances and things like that, those things are so so influenced by luck and circumstance and health and things like that. I feel like those things can be included, but you know, knocking somebody like Barkley or Malone or Stockton down a couple pegs for not having a ring feels ridiculous to me, particularly in the case of Stockton and Malone, who they played on the best teams in the West for, you know, for so many years. They just happened to play against Jordan in those two finals. So I think it's sort of a balancing act. I know. So one of the things that you have to account for statistically with a statistic like win shares is that it is somewhat, the formula is somewhat biased towards good teams. So if you are a mediocre player on a good team, you will look better by win shares than you would have on a maybe not so good team. You know, that's something to take into account. I don't have, you know, I don't have a sort of a numerical adjustment for that, but it's something to think about. You know, like Carlos Boozer always had strong defensive win shares numbers when he played on the Chicago Bulls, because that team was really good. And on some level, some of the statistics can sort of overstate a player's skills or contributions.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know how much you've had a chance to look at the numbers for, you know, the current top 50 players, but are there any that, you know, who you would look at and kind of would be, you know, really surprising, either better or worse than you expected?
I'm looking at the list right now. You sent me earlier some stats that you and Rich pulled together. I'm surprised that David Robinson's career win shares per 48 are tied with Jordan and that he's at the top of the list. That sort of surprised me. Surprised that Olajuwon's a little bit lower win shares per 48. He sort of falls more in the middle of the pack. Yeah, I don't know. There's some players here who I don't know that much about, you know, players who before my era who I'm not that familiar with. And then I see some players on the list who I think of, you know, again, probably recency bias. I have some players on this list that I'm like, I would cross them off and I would put in somebody, I'd put in somebody new. I think of this, you know, a player who I think of as being more, more of sort of a cultural pioneer or sort of having a more off the court kind of contribution to the game. You know, I'm staring at Lenny Wilkins at the bottom. And again, you know, I don't know that a ton about him as a player, but I think of him as a coach and I think of him, you know, as sort of a cultural pioneer for the game. But, you know, I feel like some current players statistically could probably squeeze him off the list.
Yeah, he's definitely one where it's sort of I think we would basically kind of agree as far as it goes. Although, he was a good player. It does seem like guards from his era, like most of them, like Hal Greer as well, although he rates reasonably well. But some of the guards, you know, have lower ranks in win shares. And I imagine that's mostly because of, you know, just low shooting percentages. It kind of hurt those players. But yeah, you know, one that's always surprised me is Isaiah Thomas being so low. I guess part of it is my perception of when I first really became a basketball fan, which was late 80s, as I viewed Isaiah as like, you know, probably like a top five player in the league. I had relative close proximity to Detroit, so that probably helped a little bit. But obviously, you know, he was the, you know, regarded at least as the best player on a team that won back-to-back championships yet, you know, and is still, you know, I mean, I think people consider him one of the, you know, in the conversation for top five point guard of all time, maybe. I feel like I've seen that thrown around yet, you know, numbers wise, it's not quite as impressive.
Yeah, you know, he, by the numbers, was not much of a 3-point shooter. And it's interesting too, his career did not last as long as some of his contemporaries. You know, he played almost 100 fewer games than Jordan, 100 fewer games than Barkley, 300 games less than Shaq, 600 games less than Stockton. So that might be an issue too. But I think he's one of those players who gets the, you know, and not that this is right or wrong, but he gets the benefit of the perception. Like, he was such a sort of a strong personality on the court, and he gave this appearance of being so in control of the game and being such a sort of master orchestrator that sort of overshadows some of the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's really tough balancing act. I'm surprised already, and we're not even quite, you know, as that deep in the research yet as far as just how, you know, it's like, wow, there's just so many things to weigh. But I mean, it's fun. I mean, the journey is going to take us to a point which we're going to pick our top 50 and we're going to weigh that. But really, I think the enjoyment is the process of just having an excuse to do research and to look up these guys and just to kind of do the sort of thinking of, you know, that it takes to just kind of put this together, just to have fun conversations like this. It's, you know, the destination itself is almost beside the point.
Yeah. what have you guys talked about the, I have no idea how to handle this statistically, but, the idea of advantages in speed and strength. Like, I'm thinking specifically of Chamberlain, who was just, you know, a foot taller than everybody else and so much stronger than everybody else. And I know from a statistical standpoint, when you look at his numbers, they look incredible, and it's I don't know how you account for the fact that the era that he played in and his sort of winning the genetic lottery gave him such a physical advantage. You know, I don't know how you compare his statistics to, you know, maybe somebody like Hakeem, who the statistics are not as good, but Hakeem had to rely on quickness and on skill level playing against, you know, players who were essentially the same size as he was.
Yeah. And I mean, that is difficult, thing to account for. I mean, I think we're mostly trying to consider the merits of a player within their own era, and think about it more that way. I mean, I don't think necessarily it's fair to penalize Chamberlain because he played in an era where, you know, there were fewer dominant big men. Although, you know, he was facing up against Russell, he was facing up against Nate Thurmond. You know, so I mean, there were certainly players that could defend him, but it was definitely a different time. And it was still a league where, you know, the athleticism clearly was at a different level. He did play most of his career. He played, you know, among a pool of, you know, there were 8 or 9 teams. So he's playing, among a pool of, let's say, 80 or 90 players, where, you know, Olajuwon is playing in a pool, let's say, of 300 players. So that creates a different environment, too. And you kind of have to kind of consider, like, well, you know, maybe you know, Olajuwon is doing something against like a third big man who wouldn't have necessarily been in the league in 1965 or whatever. You know, it's so there's those things to consider as well. And you can drive yourself crazy a little bit trying to go too deep down that path. But but it's definitely, you know, it's something worth considering, no question. I mean, I think, you know, Wilt would be on. I think Wilt would be great in any era. I mean, I think, you know, for the most part, I think these guys would have just adjusted, and obviously if they were around later, they would have, you know, had some of the same been able to take advantage of some of the same strength and development things that, you know, guys today are able to take advantage.
Yeah, it's that kind of stuff is sort of fascinating to me, and I think, you know, statistically there's no good answer for that. There's no good answer for measuring physical differences and style of play, and measuring how much easier it would be for a big man to play in an era where there was three pointers and the floor was spaced a little bit better. You know, things, some of those historical things, there's not an accounting for in the numbers.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, I guess it's just a matter of what you value and what you, you know, using the best judgment. Are there players that, you know, post-1996 candidates, let's say, who you think might have, who might be a surprisingly strong case, either, you know, by the numbers or maybe just, you know, based on your own judgment of guys that, you know, you obviously are more familiar with those guys just in general. So is there anyone that you kind of think of that would be, that might be surprising?
I think if the league did the list over today, I think LeBron would be on the list. I think Kobe would be on the list. I think Tim Duncan would be on the list. I think Dirk Nowitzki and Steve Nash would probably have a case. Jason Kidd, maybe.
Yeah. Garnett, I think, would definitely be on there.
Oh, Garnett. Yeah, Garnett's an obvious one. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe Pierce maybe is on the fringe. Chris Paul would be an interesting candidate. I don't know. He may be somebody who needs to sort of finish out his career to have the resume fully fleshed out. I don't know. Who else jumps out to you?
Well, Wade's another one.
Wade.
Yeah. After that, you're kind of getting into guys who would be worth considering, but I would consider more fringe candidates. But, I think Iverson would be just because of the influence and the fame would probably be on the list, although, you know, his merits are worth debating another time, I think. But
he's a funny candidate because he has such cultural relevance, but it was also like it was a cultural relevance that the league didn't really like. Didn't really want to sort of be out front and center. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how they would deal with that.
Yeah, I feel like it's probably like we have enough distance from that era, and I think just the culture's changed a bit, where I don't think it would be quite as negatively thought of as it was, you know, 15 years ago. Maybe I'm being naive about that, but that's kind of my thought, is that we have some distance from that. So I think some of his rebelliousness can now be appreciated more because it's not so threatening, maybe.
Yeah, I think so, probably. Ray Allen, maybe?
Yeah. Ginobili, I think, has an interesting case. We haven't really discussed whether we're considering international play at all, and there aren't really that many guys who that would really make a big difference for, but I think he would be one that, you know, you could throw in there, maybe Pau Gasol as well. There's a good number of guys who are certainly worth considering, but you know, it's a tough list, obviously. You know, we already have a lot of worthy guys on there. So, you know, other than, I think, you know, we kind of have, you know, five or six shoe-ins. After that, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it becomes really tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't envy having to make the selection. So, you know, let's say you have five or six people who are coming on. Who are the five or six who drop off the list?
I mean, that's tough. I mean, we kind of, you know, I mean, it may end up being more. I mean, I think we're going to weigh a lot of guys just to kind of, you know, consider that. But I think Bill Walton is a, just because of just, you know, he played, you know, like probably 300-400 less games than just about anybody on the list, I think, and really was only an elite player for a couple of seasons. I think he might be off the list. Dave Bing and Maravich are guys who their reputations are probably better than their actual play was. Maravich certainly had, you know, some of the cultural influence and just the flashiness and the highlights, you know, kind of add some. I think that adds something, but I ultimately don't think that's enough. You know, maybe James Worthy, who was a, you know, obviously an important contributor to an elite team, but you know, if you're making that argument, he's definitely behind a guy like McHale, and pretty solidly behind a guy like Parrish as well. So I mean, I think those are the kind of the first guys who I would lean toward knocking off the list, but you know, I mean, those are obviously important, very good, you know, great players. Earl Monroe would be another one who would, I think, kind of be in that category as well, of a guy who, you know, because he was colorful, partly because of being on those Knicks teams, gets a shine that's, I think, a little bit more than, you know, his productivity was just that he deserves.
Mm-hmm. It's funny too to think about players who sort of get a bump, not just from being on good teams, but being on sort of those signature teams, like those 70s Knicks, the 1970 Knicks, you know, or the Walton with those Trailblazers, you know, there's good teams every year, but there's a few teams who sort of stand out in our memory. And yeah, I wonder if Monroe's getting a bump from that.
Yeah. I think there are four players on those, 60s Knicks that are, or 70s Knicks, excuse me, that are on this list. So, Walt Frazier's clearly, belongs, and, Willis Reed clearly belongs. And I mean, DeBuscher, his numbers don't grade out well, but he was an incredible defender, and, you know, you can definitely, you know, see why he would have been put on there. And Moreau, you know, he was obviously, you know, he was an incredible player. Just, you know, his production, you know, just was a little bit less than some, probably some other deserving guys are on there. But, you know, again, you know, you, with the goals that they had in mind, you can definitely see why he, you know, belongs on this. And I would say our goals are fairly similar. We may weigh kind of, you know, we may weigh the numbers a little more heavily than these guys did, but understandably, these were guys mostly who played in the league, some, you know, some sports writers, some, you know, executives, so their perspective is going to be different. And, you know, our hope is just to kind of – obviously is to have fun and also to sort of maybe challenge some, you know, some assumptions that might that might have historically been made, and just examine, like, oh, is that really the case? Or in some cases it'll obviously confirm it, and in other cases maybe will, you know, spur some thought into challenging it.
Yeah, it's I'm actually glad I don't have to make my own list. I'm staring at this and looking at all the tough decisions. Yeah.
So anything else before we wrap up?
No, I think that's it. I know this went kind of quickly, but, yeah, I think I'm out of ideas right now.
All right. Well, I, appreciate you, joining in. Definitely, great to get your thoughts. Definitely wanted to get your take on this. And, I think you may, rejoin us to talk about a couple of the players that we're going to look into a little bit more deeply here on in the future. So looking forward to that and to all the stuff that we do. And, and everyone, thanks so much for, checking us out. You can find us, we're part of the, Hardwood Paroxysm family, the Podium Game Network. You can find our show on iTunes. Please leave a rating and review. That's a way that you can definitely help other people find us and all the other great podcasts on the network. And find us on Twitter at Over and Back NBA, also on Facebook. So check those places out, and we'll be back again soon. Thanks so much.